Friends, our theme this day, this Sunday, is stewardship. We'll ask what it is, where a spirit of generosity comes from, how we can grow in it, why it matters, what the consequences are for a church of generous givers or a church of withholders. But the terrible things that have happened in Paris in the last 2 days caused me to want to bring that into the spirit of our sermon as well. And though I will offer a sermon on stewardship, I want to lift up an aspect of that that may be in the background of your thinking about what has happened in Paris. We're going to say today, in several different ways, that stewardship is integrity. They're really the same thing. Stewardship is integrity. And integrity involves great honesty about how bad things are and about how much power God gives us. Great honesty. And so, as we listen to the awful cry of the people of France, and frankly of all the world that sorrows with them, we need also to hear the echo of the cries of people who die violently, which are unheard. And we also need to be honest about how much our own nation, the United States of America, has contributed to the terrifying violence of this world. We ourselves are thoroughly implicated in the violence of the Middle East. We can't go saying they started it. We're all involved. It's like braids of evil designs that have been in the minds of men. Why? In order to get more wealth for themselves. We are, as a nation, often just like the man in Jesus' parable who tears down the laws in order to make more money for wealthy people, more power for powerful people. And so we are implicated in the great sorrows of this world. And while we do not in one moment of our heart break off from fellowship with the grief of France, or frankly the grief of Russia in the loss of 200 and some citizens from a plane that was brought down, we think. Still, the mind of the integral person, the whole person, the person who is recognizing his stewardship, her stewardship for the whole earth, is one that is alert to how tragic are the ways of the nations, including our own. And begin from that spirit of contrition to ask for a way forward that is not the same as the ancient way, which is violence upon violence upon violence. Now, with that prelude, which I would not have offered had the things in Paris not happened so recently, let us go deeper into our thinking about stewardship. What is it? The word fallen on rocky ground. You know, church people use it like a nose clothespin. I got to talk about money. I don't want to smell it. I don't like to talk about it. It's a euphemism for raising money in the church, at any rate. And we have come to a bad pass. You know, sex matters and money matters are big deals in our lives, but the church kind of doesn't want to talk about either one. It's as if God was sent to spirit us away into love and being kind and never talking about the things that really drive inside our lives all the rest of the week. That's a church problem. It's been going on for a long time. And, of course, this habit of dividing godliness from the real lives we're living, this does not affect God. God is still involved in all 7 days, 7 nights of our lives. But if we pretend God's not here in our lives or out there in our lives, we're the ones, not God, we're the ones who end up seeing small and being small and anxious and ignorant and stingy and mean and violent and stuck. It doesn't work to have stewardship mean
fundraising.
What is stewardship? Stewardship begins with a call. Who hasn't called a bunch of people together to try to get into a picture? You say, come on, squeeze him, left, come on, oh, come on, everything, get into the picture. That's, stewardship is like that, except it's a call to you. Come on, bring in all the parts of you into this picture. Every part of you, the good stuff, the bad stuff, how you be friend, how you be family, how you be kind, how you be mean. You know, listen to the psalmist. The psalmist says, what are human beings that you are mindful of us? Yet you've made us little lower than gods. You crowned us with glory and honor. You've given us rule over all your works. You put everything under our feet. And goodness knows, in the thousands of years since the psalmist wrote, humans' power to have all things under their control in this earth has only multiplied vastly. So stewardship is getting all these things into the picture, even things in your own life that you don't really have a handle on yet. Things you don't speak about easily and maybe haven't even honestly admitted to yourself yet. Bring it in the picture, because God is there with you in the life you're really leading. Really with you. No matter what's going on, the good and the bad, your work, your relationships with your co-workers, what you fear, how you use time, how you kill time. What you hope, what you stand for, what you won't stand for, all of it. Bring it all into the picture. These are the stores of great value for which God has crowned you to be master, mistress of. This is your stewardship. It amounts to this. Everyone and everything in your care and every part of your whole self, including also the whole world of which you are a citizen for a few decades, precious decades. All of these you have stewardship for, to guard, to decide. Basically, as I said earlier, stewardship is integrity. It's being honest about the whole story. Good stewardship, think of it like this. It's as if God and you were looking at your checkbook and your credit card bills, and the entire calendar of your days, including all the hours of sleep, going over every line and every hour together, and with a gladness of heart, this is good stewardship, with some gladness of heart, you're giving an account to your God of why you spent it this way and not that way, in every single line visible to you and your God with an accounting. That's the integrity of good stewardship. Stewardship also means coming to terms with the fact that some of what you do with your life, it's a waste. You're not proud of it. Be honest. I don't mean stand up in the middle of the congregation and cry out your sins the way John Wesley had it back in the 1700s. That did not work, by the way. He did it about three Sundays and the whole people clammed up. It didn't work at all. But finding ways to be honest. How important this is to us. Stewardship means finding soul friends who can help you order your life and your values. Actually having that relationship. And the church is the best place in the world in which to develop that kind of personal soul friend relationship. Stewardship is about priority and clarity and vision and hope. And when we understand the word this fully, no more
fundraising,
this big picture of stewardship, it's the sweetest sound, the sweetest fragrance in the world, one prepared for your God. Now, lots of churches have stewardship programs and stewardship committees and a stewardship Sunday. That's pretty common. But given this immense and all-embracing meaning of stewardship that we're thinking about now, doesn't a stewardship campaign taste a little bit like dry potatoes? It's so small. It doesn't belong in a few weeks of the year. It's actually the whole relationship of honesty and hope, and as we said, vision and clarity for the world. So what's happened? Why did churches get so small about this word and about these ways of being open and integrous and hopeful? Why, in a word, has stewardship become a kind of awkward, if sincere, way of trying to get you to give up a little more of your money? Well, the simple answer is because you don't. Right? Why would the churches have developed such programs if the people were liberal? Giving. The resistance to giving is what has given rise to these rather awkward systems by which people are being coddled and coerced sometimes sort of into more giving. It's resistance that's given rise to it. Think of those Macedonian Christians that Paul was writing about as he addressed the church at Corinth. He remembered that the Corinthians had been eager. He hoped they still were, but he was writing from a long distance. He had a more recent experience of extreme excitement, of excitement to be given into the needs of the Jerusalem church. And so, in praising them, we know that there wasn't any stewardship committee in the Macedonian churches. It just flowed. The proof of this is also much nearer to us in time. There are religious communities that do not struggle over financial commitments at all. The Jewish synagogue, by and large, doesn't struggle at all. The Mormon churches don't struggle. Lots of black churches, in the American sense of that word, the traditions of the African American churches frequently don't struggle at all. Here's an account from Peter Gomes, former chaplain of Harvard University, writing in The Good Book, published maybe 20 years ago. He says, "White people who visit black churches are often surprised and not a little shocked at the number of offerings there, and with the fine art of encouraging people to generosity. It takes the white people some time to realize that the giving of money is the central drama in the act of worship. It was high theater for me as a child, with the whole congregation on view and in motion, the murmuring of the stewards as they counted, the relentless rhythm of the singing, and the anxious moments while waiting the result." So we see, certainly there are stewards in these generous congregations, but there's just no stewardship campaign because it's so thoroughly a part of their experience of freedom and generosity and flow. So what can we learn from those kind of communities about generosity without trying to copy their practices as if they would work here? We don't know that they would work here, but what can we learn? First thing I want to raise up: you were not born generous. And a good thing, too. You were born selfish. With that first cry out of your mouth, You're asking for something to be given to you, and a good thing too. You know, every creature is wired like this from birth for self-concern, and any that doesn't have it doesn't thrive. It matters to be concerned, to be wired with attention to your own needs. This is why we naturally, not supernaturally, but naturally approach money decisions a little bit like worried animals, with our ears pricked up, wondering, what's the least I can pay for that? This is natural. It's an ordinary thing. Of course we like that. We were not born generous. Sometimes having money feels like a shelter, if not from a current storm, from a future storm, right? So our natural self-concern, that's what retirement funds and accounts are all about, is a storm is coming, I need shelter. That's ordinary. Sometimes spending money substitutes for loves that we crave and can't get for what reason or another. And so we spend on ourselves or spend on somebody. It becomes a substitute for love. We long to taste life deeply, to feel the pulsing energies of our hungers and our satisfactions in love and work and in play and in dreams of the future. We long for that. And money sometimes makes these emotional, it's like electricity flowing through our wiring. We get that. Of course it's like that. God knows this. You heard Jesus' word to his disciples. God knows you need these things. But be careful that you not make them what you're seeking for first. So long as we hold back from becoming generous, so long as we're fearful about the future, we forestall our new birth in the generation of the generous. Now, it was to help us feel the contrast between how we were born and what we risk losing if we are not reborn generous. Jesus told the story of the rich man on that day when he figured out his plan would be to build new barns to hold all his wealth. Jesus wants the contrast between that planful anxiousness and the risk of it to be really clear for us. Not a word does Jesus spend scolding him for being a sensuous man, spending too much money on wine or women or song or whatever. No, no, this rich man's obsession, it's not with sensuous pleasure. His great anxiety is to make more of himself. Just to manufacture more of himself. In fact, as I'd said earlier, rich men in our times tear down the laws of the country so that they can build up their own wealth. That wasn't possible in Jesus' day. He saw the man tearing down the barns of his land so he could make more money. And then, though he is battling blindly with his fear that his life is worth nothing, that's what's really going on, he gets a visit from the angel of death. And he says, it was always set for tonight, your death. And now, what have you got? You've got a plan to build big barns, and you're going to die tonight without the plan mattering, and you never learned how to be a human, how to grow, how to understand that God made you a little lower than an angel, able in freedom to give and receive. But you've never discovered this freedom, this godly freedom to give freely. You've never learned that in order to grow, we let go. There's no other way forward for a real human. To grow, you gotta let go. Jesus says, only the nations strive like this man. Only the nations. The nations really means anyone, everyone who have not yet decided to become human, to become born again generous. And in fact, of course, everybody lives with these conflicts in those churches that are abundant with their giving, as well as every other church which may be less so. Everybody lives with these conflicts. So the question might be, what helps give birth to generosity? That's the real question, isn't it? Tightly knit communities such as those we described, American, African American communities, are very tightly knit, often Jewish synagogues, Mormon communities. These are working like laboratories to generate generosity in the young people and in the new members. They support one another with experimentation. You know, practice, try it out. God gives the gift of greater freedom in generosity, but you've got to try and experience the tension within in order for God's gift to become alive to you. And these churches we've described have practice in encouraging and developing this freedom in their members. The spiritual and emotional benefits of participation in these communities are known and felt and real. The church identity is clear. The mission commitments are clear. And members are born, reborn, more generous. Now, by contrast, in the church, I hope yours is not like this, but I'm going to describe the far extreme, a church where the leaders feel the need to pump, push, pull, get that money out of the people. Well, where there's that kind of anxious resistance, all the conditions that are so favorable in tightly knit communities are absent. The people don't trust their leaders. They don't experience emotional and spiritual benefits in ways they could articulate easily and clearly. They don't sense the church's identity. They don't connect with its mission in the community. So naturally they withhold. Now, what's a church like that to do? It's not that there's nothing to do. And frankly, the tendency to guilt trip people for small giving has very small returns. It doesn't work at all. Never guilt trip anybody, ever. It's not the way forward. It's not Jesus' way. And understand this too. It is a fact that in a congregation of great diversity, and Forest Hills has come from a tradition of immense diversity. The last time I preached among you, your former pastor Charles was present. The late pastor Charles, yes. And I learned from him directly that there were 28 nationalities represented at Forest Hills. This is just 6 years ago. I don't know what the number might be today, but I can tell with my own two eyes. It's still substantial reality. Let's face something. Where there is great ethnic and or intellectual or diversity in creed and backgrounds of various kinds, wherever there is great diversity, it is harder to experience the unity of mission. Right? It's just what it takes more energy. So you have to cut yourself some slack, some, that's not the best word, but be forgiving on how hard it is sometimes to arrive at a sense of unity and mission. And perhaps you're there. I'm not right up to date on the experience of First Forest Hills. So you be the judge, not me, of that. But let's be plain. If there are difficulties in a church where there's a lot of resistance, the stewardship campaign idea does not dissolve the knot. It doesn't open up the heart, usually, because it's too much focused on trying to get you, the individual that is, to think about the budget. And that is not Jesus' way. To say, you know, you gotta pay for this stuff. That is not the way toward being born generous. That's a totally, these are totally different things. Being born generous is a spiritual process. It's a God thing. And attending to the material things isn't, they're just two very different practices. So let them be as separate as possible. Yes, of course the bills need to be paid as your elder just laid out for you. But your task as a church with and for one another is to help one another experiment in the wonderful practices of being born anew, generous. You know, everybody loves the story of Scrooge in A Christmas Tale. I mean, I think literally, everybody who knows that story loves it. Maybe I'm wrong. Well, why? Here we have a guilty, selfish, withholding nature, the very kind of church that's in trouble that we just described, except it's embodied in one figure, Scrooge. And he is reborn in justice and generosity. How? By means of those visits from the whole big picture, right? Calling all the parts of him, his past, his future, his present, all of these are called into one picture as if by God, and he sees all his good and all his evil and his terror and his hopes crowding into the picture together. And then by spiritual helps, this is the church's gift. Nobody else is doing this out in society. By spiritual helps, Scrooge understands that he himself is indwelled by a spirit so much greater than all his fears and even all his hopes, that he is blessed and forgiven. All of him, past, present, future, holds together. He has integrity. You know, that's what that word means. One, an integer. He's one. He's an individual. He has integrity. He has real stewardship. You know the story. I'm not going to retell it, how he uses it. He is born again generous. So this is our calling. To wake up as a church, as individuals, like Scrooge woke up on Christmas Day. Scrooge does not have to suffer through a fall program marinating him in guilt about making the budget. Stewardship is like midwifing members into trust and generosity. The whole aim of a church's stewardship must simply be to help you experiment with practices and disciplines that develop your freedom to be generous. Try it out. That's what a church is supposed to do. To try out deciding with integrity how to put your time and your money where you intend by the grace of God to give it. And day by day, a church full of stewards is learning that you give up in order to grow up. That this is the maturing process. This is how it works. Abundant, generous, eager, like Paul's Macedonian Christians. Giving, by the way, according to what you have, not according to what you don't have, right? Proportional giving. So how much should you give? You know. Experiment. That's the answer. Experiment with giving enough to make a spiritual difference in your life. That's it. Giving that doesn't make a difference ain't it. That's not a prayer to God to be born generous. Many years ago, I was a new pastor in a small village church upstate. Coming out of graduate school, this was my first pastorate. I was very glad to be working again, and I was glad to be contributing to my church well more than I had during grad school to the church I attended. But you know, well more than a very little can still be very little. It's about arithmetic. Now, I suddenly felt convicted that I was giving too little when, on a certain afternoon during my first month there, I was sorting through office clutter left by the former pastor. And I found there in the old man's family budget, it was reckoned in his own handwriting, it listed amounts for all the usual needs and also his offering for the church. I looked at the number. I stared at it. It was a whole lot more than I was then giving. You know, I think my face flushed. It was the full tithe. I could figure out what his salary might have been. This was the whole tithe. I'd never met that old man, and I had thought the disarray of the office was kind of an epitaph on his worn-out old man ministry. But now this man was speaking to me in a very lively way. I felt questioned, tested, tutored in a language I did not know how to speak. Could I let go of money like that? I thought, could. And then I thought, well, why not? If I could, why not? And so I decided right there, that's how these things come, don't they? That I would give a proportion that I could feel in my life. And 10 minutes before, a figure like that would have seemed like it came from the moon. But now, in an instant, I could sense the flow and the freedom and the decision. I was born generous then. And it's not a once-for-all being born, by the way. It's been necessary for me to be born generous again since those days 30 years ago. But here's a funny little story. The end of my sermon. Some years later, I was telling this story to that church in a sermon. And afterward, the treasurer of the church came up to me. He had a kind of a funny smile on his face. He said, "That is a great story, Pastor. It's even got old Scottish me thinking." But you ought to know that the former pastor never gave that much. It turns out that I learned the language of generosity from the practice book of a man who was not fluent in it. He was just wishing and hoping, but he wasn't there yet. But I followed him. Or God filled me, which is much more like it, right? I'm still learning this language, this being born generous, and I'm not learning it from a book. I learn it from practice in the church. That is how we are born generous. Paul puts it really plainly. He says, "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." Amen.